So you can't outperform your self-image. So if you think that you're not a fast runner and you're looking around and going, oh, there's all these fast runners here, I'm going to come last today, then that's where you're going to finish. So if you believe that something's going to happen, you're 99% of the way there to believing, executing and finding that it does happen.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Hey, welcome. My guest this week is Andrew Gardner. Andrew's a mental performance scholar and coach. He's also a clinical neuropsychologist working primarily with athletes who've had concussions. He's also an ultra runner, presently training for the Boston Marathon. He has a lot of wisdom to share. Here's my conversation with Andrew Gardner. How did you become a mental performance scholar and what does that entail?
It's probably just a self-professed thing. So I have done mental performance coaching training officially with Brian Kane's program out of he's based in Arizona, but I'm also a graduate of psychology, and I've been really interested in mental performance for a long time and other sports that I was involved in. I was always in high performance sports and had a lot to do with sports psychology, and so I guess I'm referring to myself as a scholar because I'm always trying to learn. And working with athletes on their mental performance gives me an opportunity to learn a lot, and I can teach them strategies to perform better and execute their skills well, but I also learn a lot from them when they go about doing that and how they execute those strategies, implement those strategies, and how it works for them, what doesn't work for them, and just continually learning is really the key.
Yeah, well, that's cool, and it's good to be a scholar. I mean, I think the people who think they have things figured out, sometimes I suspect whether they get to that point in life is like, yeah, you don't know, you want people who are always trying to push and learn more.
There's an interesting theory that you and your listeners might be interested in called the Dunning-Kruger effect. So if people wanted to go and Google that and have a look at it, that would be really interesting. I'm sure it enlightens people about the more you start to learn, the more you realize you don't know. And then you get to kind of this stage of enlightenment where you realize you do know a lot, but there's still lots more to learn. And when novices start out in any kind of task, they think they know everything there is to know about it, and they're overly confident in their abilities. But as they gradually get more experience, they realize that they have a lot to learn. So it's a very interesting concept.
Yes, that is. And I've heard that expressed in talking about teenagers. A person saying, you know, when I was in my teens, my dad was the biggest idiot, that ever lived. And now that I'm 30, I think he's brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. That's good.
I think we tend to go through those stages where we realize that, you know, and that's something I've tried to do with this show as well as my own life. I want to keep learning. I have friends who have, you know, at some point started to coast in life, and it always made me sad because I keep thinking I want to grow. So
yeah.
Well, and you're tell a little bit about what you do professionally as well. Yeah. I know you're in the education field.
Yeah, so I'm a clinical neuropsychologist. So my area of expertise and interest is thinking skills. So I do assessments of people's cognition, and so my specific area of interest and I've become quite well known for it is sports concussion. So I've worked with a lot of the elite level players right down to the community and grassroots level, looking at how to prevent the injury, assess the injury, identify the injury, and then my biggest research program that I'm involved in is having a look at the retired players and what the potential long-term consequences of a career in contact and collision sports is like for them. So I've had an opportunity to test over 160 elite-level rugby league players here in Australia, and I've personally sat down with them for 2.5 hours each and assessed them and given them feedback on their performance and put that into a research database. And we've collaborated with some colleagues over in the US at Harvard to publish a few papers in that area as well.
I know that I've read some things about neuroplasticity. Is there in people who have had concussions, is there an ability to either access different parts of the brain or being able to adapt?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very, very important concept. And I think the education of the community, not only parents who make decisions for their kids about when they should return to play or if they should play at all, neuroplasticity hasn't really got a lot of airtime, and it certainly should, because the brain is very, very good at recovering and very good at adapting while other areas recover from an insult or an injury. And concussion by definition is a functional disturbance, and so functionally things need to get back to normal, and that typically does occur spontaneously over a short period of time. For some people, they take a little bit longer to recover. And then for some people, unfortunately, there could be long-term consequences, and we're really trying to discover and understand that. But neuroplasticity certainly plays a huge role. Cognitive reserve is another thing that plays a huge role, and that basically is a concept of those that keep their brain active, like what you're talking about before with your colleagues and friends coasting in life. Keeping your brain active is really, really important for not only neuroplasticity, but earlier in life learning. We're talking about learning before in education is really important as well, because these kind of insults that you may have occur to your brain, you can bounce back from much quicker with strong cognitive reserve and neuroplasticity.
So how does physical activity and especially running kind of fall into that, because you are a runner and you've done some ultras and you're training for Boston, I read as well.
That's my big A race this year is Boston. I've got a 45 kilometer race coming up in 12 days in the Blue Mountains here in Sydney, which is exciting. It's one of the toughest off-road races, marathons in Australia. So that's going to be exciting. And I'll do my best there, but I'm not going to jeopardize my potential to do really, really well at Boston, which is only a month after that. So we'll see how that goes. But running certainly is huge for your mental health. As lots of people probably already know, and you yourself probably know, the endorphins that kick around inside the brain, the dopaminergic system, and the nucleus accumbens firing, that's all our reward system, part of the limbic system in the brain. And any kind of, I guess, at extremes, addictions, but in good measure, things that you enjoy and get pleasure from, that lights up that system and makes that system stronger. So we're talking about neuroplasticity before. The more you use something, the more you do something, the more you get rewarded for that. And certainly running does that for a lot of people, being active, getting those endorphins running around and really hitting that pleasure center makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get started as a runner?
I guess I've always been athletic and involved in athletics. And I think I've always run, but I've never taken it that seriously. And it was actually as a result of COVID striking and me working from home and having a little bit more time to be able to get out and run, where I joined a local run club, Run Lab. And I'm wearing the shirt now, actually. Being part of a group where it was more formalized and structured training in a group, and just being able to really improve, I think, exponentially because of the structure and the environment that I was starting to train in. It's just improved my running exponentially, as I said. And it's something that it's always been part of my life. I've gone out and just run when I felt like it, but now I have a real structured program and some A races to aim for, and it's really exciting. But love the trails, love getting out and just running.
Yeah,
really awesome.
Well, and your run club, it does have a fairly structured training plan. I mean, I've seen some of your run with you're pulling somebody behind you with a strap. I remember seeing some of those. So was that just part of what the club naturally does? Do they have some sort of a coach that founded it?
Yeah,
because I know a lot of run clubs kind of run the gamut. The run club I'm a part of, we run and drink beer, And so,
So
how did this get to be a rather structured training club?
Yeah. So, so the head coach and the founder of the business is Vlad Shatrov, and he's an elite level runner. He won the Tarawera Ultra Marathon, 160 kilometer. So the 100 miler just before COVID struck and broke the course record by 45 minutes. He is, elite level runner. He almost qualified for the Olympics for the marathon to represent Australia a number of Olympics ago. And he basically sets up the whole program. So we've structured it along the school term. So we have 10-week terms where we are focused on certain areas. So it might be strength, and what you were describing before was the harnesses on the beach. We were doing a very structured strength set. And then we would do hill runs and stairs and all sorts of things as a program of building the strength over the term. And we also do, outside of just the running groups, is that we get together and do strength training. So in the gym with bands, with weights, own body exercises, those kinds of things, which helps reduce the risk of injury and improves the strength for the ultra runners as well. Really, really good to be in that team environment.
Yeah, yeah. And it's much more of it's like a team almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the mental performance coach as well, so I do a fair bit of coaching of all of the athletes that are part of the club in terms of the mental performance and the mental approach to not only training but your races as well.
So what is kind of the things that people – that you coach, you know, what are some of the things that they need help with, or you know, what are the things that you encourage them to focus on?
Well, that's a really great question, and there's a whole lot, and it's all really intertwined as well. But one of the things is your self-image. So you can't outperform your self-image. So if you think that you're not a fast runner and you're looking around and going, oh, there's all these fast runners here, I'm going to come last today, then that's where you're going to finish. So if you believe that something's going to happen, you're 99% of the way there to believing, executing and finding that it does happen. So one of the things is really we've talked a lot about self-image, how to grow the self-image, how to avoid shrinking the self-image. Then also it's really important to have goals and structures, and we've talked about the process of setting goals. So it's not just outcome goals that we're interested in. We don't want to run a marathon in under 3 hours. What we want to do is to talk about the processes of having goals of how you want to achieve various training blocks and what you want to do in those training blocks. So it's a process goal that you have more control over, whereas the outcome you don't necessarily, because it's my goal to run under 3 hours at Boston, but if it's snowing or if it's a 40 degree Celsius day, that's going to make it a whole lot harder for that goal to be realistic. So then I need to change it, but I'm training hard so that I can try and break that 3 hour mark at the moment, but it's a goal that I don't necessarily have control over. So it's about process goals. So we talk about self-image, we talk about goals, we talk about just in terms of processing things to grow that self-image, as I said before. We also talk about motivation and key strategies for staying motivated. One of the biggest things that I always teach is really life is a strategy game. It's not a talent game. So if you've got the right strategies, you can achieve anything that you want to. So making sure we set up the right strategies to achieve success is really the way to go. And then also I think a lot of people who are listening may have a fear of failure, and that's one of the things that is really, really difficult to break through and overcome. So we talk about strategies of not being worried about what people think of you and changing the whole concept of what failure actually means. So if you don't achieve a race speed on a certain day, that can be perceived as being a failure. It might shrink your self-image, but if you can look at it as I trained for 16 weeks leading up to that and look at how much I grew and how much strength I got. And yes, I didn't execute to the standard I wanted to do on race day, but look at everything positive that came from that. It's not a failure. It's just an obstacle that I need to overcome for next time. Learn from the lessons that are learnt or taught, come up with strategies for overcoming that next time it comes up, and away you go. So that's really, in a nutshell, some of what we talk about. Obviously, it's not everything, but
right. Yeah, that's a good, that's kind of a good overview of things that people can work on. So, as in training for mental performance, is that done in conjunction with your regular physical training, or is that something that they can work on in in off times as well.
Yeah, combination of both. One of the things that I didn't say is how we bring ourselves back to being present moment focused. So we talk about, or I've taught about, being in a green light, which means you're under control, in an amber light situation where you're starting to lose control, and the red light situation is where you've lost control. So if you're at the 80-mile mark in a 100-mile race and you're just feeling terrible, you feel depleted, you start to get thoughts of, I haven't put enough nutrition in, this checkpoint's a little bit too far away, my muscles are sore, my whole body's sore, maybe I didn't train very hard, or maybe I haven't trained hard enough to get through this section, oh, there's a hill coming up, this is just going to break me, maybe I should pull out. All of these negative thoughts that are coming in, you need to identify them early, and then you need to have a release strategy where you get rid of those thoughts, bring yourself back to the present moment and the reason why you're doing all of these things, so that you can be free of all that junk and baggage that you're carrying and push forward with the strategy of, this is my race goals, this is my race strategy, I need to get back into that present moment focused and move forward. So we can do that in training. So we can do a really hard, tough set in training, and then we say, blow a whistle and 30 seconds of focus, where they go into that situation where, hang on, I'm hurting, I'm going to get rid of that, get back into the present moment, have my visual cue, my physical cue, and my verbal cue. So it might be my mind's crack on, so I'm just clicking my fingers, looking at a visual cue of my watch, and then crack on. That gets me back into the present moment focused, and away we go. So that strategy can be done at home, it can be done during a training session. The other one is really mental imagery. It's a huge thing to get involved in. So if you're able to, at night, spend 15 minutes just imagining yourself achieving something that you want to achieve, or going through a race strategy, or executing at a training session. One of the quotes that I really, really like about mental imagery is that your event occurs twice. Once in your head, you're imagining it, and then you go out and execute it. So the more vivid you can make those images, the brain can't distinguish between it actually happening, so you're going out and doing it, versus you just imagining yourself doing it. So you're reinforcing yourself achieving something. So if you continue to do that mental imagery and you see yourself achieving it, when you go out to execute, you just go through the routine of what you've already done, but physically you're doing it this time, and you're able to go out and execute it. Because half the battle is believing that you can actually achieve what you've set out to do. If it's your first ever miler, or if it's your first ever 100-kilometer event, your first ever marathon, your first ever half marathon, your first ever 10K, your first ever 5K, it doesn't matter what the distance is.
Yeah.
So if you strongly believe that you're capable of doing it, then you're 85% of the way there to achieving it. But if you have that doubt and you start having those negative thoughts reinforced, and as you go through the process of executing, those thoughts keep weighing you down, then you're going to really, really struggle. It's going to be a whole lot harder than it needs to be if you can just get back on track with your mental preparation and your mental execution during the event.
Yeah, interesting when I hear, you know, some people talk to me, find out how far I've run. They say, "Well, I can't imagine running that far," mm-hmm. and in their very words, it's like, well, that's kind of why you don't do it. Is that it has to start in that imagination, and that and being able to say, wow, you know, I think most of us are all capable of more than, you know, even, you know, what we think, because we keep our imagination from going there.
Yeah, absolutely. Life's a strategy game, not a talent game. If you've got the strategy and you believe, you can certainly achieve anything.
What can people do if they have difficulty creating those images? I mean, the mental images. I mean, I tend to be more of not so much of a visual person as other people that I know, and sometimes I struggle with really getting a good vivid image. So, any strategies for making that?
Yeah, better? Absolutely. So the best place to start is to go back in your memory bank to a time when you did execute really well. So it might have been a 5-kilometer race where you just felt wonderful and it was like the wind was blowing you along and you just executed really well, you got your PB. Go back to there and rehearse what happened and imagine yourself doing it again and get strong at doing that. And once you start to establish, okay, I've done this before and I remember what it felt like, I remember how it smelt, I remember what we don't have too many tastes, but if you're running a long one, you might be tasting the thing that you get in. Yeah. But you making it vivid with all of your senses. And if you've been there and done it before, it's easier to start creating that image and recreating that image. And then once you get really good at that, you can transfer that to a future event. So you've maybe in a course that you've never run before, but you kind of got an idea of what it potentially looks like. And then you just imagine yourself doing it. But also, if you can do training on the course that you're going to run on, then that's great as well, because you can then take in all the stimuli while you're doing your training run, continue to execute the training run, but also think about what it'll be like on race day. So you're kind of putting yourself in race day and doing that. Then when you go home that night and other nights subsequently, you can then put yourself back in that position because you've been there and you've seen it, and you can recreate that image, and then you're executing on race day. So strategies are, yeah, just number one, take it back to where you've been before and try and get good at creating that image and then project it forward to a future event.
And it's some of the language I heard you using is that it seems that emotion has to be a kind of a part of that as well. It can't just be your thoughts.
Yep. No, absolutely. The more vivid you make it through those sensory experiences, the better the image is and the more powerful it will be. So, yeah, the more you bring in how you feel, what you're thinking of at the time, potentially who might be around you, what the terrain looks like, the sounds, the sight, the smells, all that kind of stuff. If you're running through a pine forest, you can smell the pines, just all that kind of thing makes it way, way stronger. And the brain is like, yep, I've been here before. When you get there to execute on race day, yep, I've done this before and I've run really fast through here.
That's cool. So, and I think I saw you've run 100K too. Are you most of your races there in Australia?
Yeah. So I did run in the UTA Australia last year, which is probably our number one. So that's the Ultra Trails Australia. It's probably our number one trail event. It's part of the World Series now that they've created. So unfortunately, at 22 kilometer mark, I had a bit of a my leg slid out sideways and I almost went down, but I caught myself and brought myself back in, but I felt a twinge really high up on my groin and it was uncomfortable. I pushed on for another 30-ish Ks, but then I decided that it was probably getting worse and I should stop. So I did stop, and I woke up the next day feeling absolutely fine. So I was pretty upset with my decision. So 2 weeks later, with my friends at Run Lab, I went to a local 100-kilometer course and went and executed the race that I should have executed 2 weeks before, so I got it done. And they created a trophy for me, which I've got just sitting up here, saying that I was first place because it was not really a race at all. So I got the medal.
So looking back on that, was that really a physical thing, or was it kind of a mindset thing? Or could you tell? I mean, looking back, you always have better insight than you do when you're in the race. I mean, is that one of the things that?
Yeah, no, I certainly
was chosen differently.
Yeah, I probably am happy with my decision, and I think that's the way you need to process it as well. You can't be regretting it, but you can learn from the lessons. I think that I was at 55K, so I still had another 45Ks to go, and I don't know what kind of damage I could have potentially done in that following 45Ks, and there was a lot of stairs up and down and a lot of hills to go. Aside from that injury, I was feeling pretty good and pretty strong, and I did want to keep going. So I don't think it was mental. I don't think I was taking a shortcut or trying to get out of achieving what I did. And I think that's kind of reflected in me 2 weeks later, just making sure I went out there and executed the 100Ks. If I do get in a position like that again, I probably will try and push a little harder in the 35-ish Ks that I did, where I was nursing it and taking it easy, just to test it out and make sure that it is problematic, and then just pull out earlier, just so it'll be fresher. It was interesting that I woke up the next day and everything felt pretty good. I was tired because I'd still done 55Ks, but
right.
The injury was not as bad as it felt like it was.
So what does an athlete do? How do they how do they balance that? I mean, because I know people who have run, you know, finished the race and ended up with stress fractures and really done physical damage. So, I mean, what do you kind of tell people to look for to kind of judge that, you know, whether to go stay or go?
Yeah, I would always say that it's probably largely a decision that you need to make before you even enter into the race. So you need to know what potentially could happen, and you've got a strategy for how to overcome it. So that's what we talk about at Run Lab with the race plans. So we talk about every possible scenario. We put a rating on what's the likelihood of this particular thing that we've identified happening, and what's the decision that I would make as a result of this particular thing happening. Really, really important. And I think it's always individual differences, and there's always individual scenarios that we're talking about here. So it would depend on what the rest of your racing calendar is like for the rest of the year and further along. So if I picked up an injury in the Boston Marathon, for example, in a few months' time, I'm finishing that race no matter what. And if it jeopardizes my UTA performance a month later, I'm happy with that. I'm not too worried about that. But if the subsequent races throughout the year are important to you and you don't want to miss them, then you really need to consider and weigh up how much damage you've done and how much more damage you will potentially do if you continue going, and then just decide based on that. So I think the examples that you've given probably happen more frequently than we know. it just all depends on those individuals.
Well, and I think the attitude some people have is, you know, with performance is that they're, you know, your mind can drive your body, you know, past the point of, I mean, and so having a strong mind, you know, strong mindset, strong mental performance, it doesn't necessarily, you can end up damaging your body.
Yeah. And, that's correct. So, I know a few people that, they have the motto that you don't fail to finish.
Yes.
And so unless you're about to die, that's the only reason why you'd fail to finish. So that gung-ho approach can be problematic, and you've got to give yourself a bit of a break if something happens that you just don't have control of, or you do pick up an injury that's fairly serious. You need to drop the ego and just, you know, pull yourself into line and look after yourself, because it's not just your running that gets affected, it's the rest of your life as well. So your family then needs to put up with you being injured, and you can't train, you start to get deconditioned, and then it takes a lot longer to come back from that injury if it's more serious than it would have otherwise been. So lots of things to weigh up.
Yeah. So you've got Boston that you're training for, and you're also raising funds. So I wanted to give you a chance to plug your your fundraisers.
That's very good of you. Yes. For those that already know, with the Boston Marathon, they have a charity partner they have lots of charities, sorry. And the fundraising platform that is universally used exclusively is Give and Gain. And so the that's a platform that every charity raises their funds from. Now, the charity that I'm raising funds for is the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, which is based in Charlestown, which is right in the heart of Boston, just across the harbour from Boston City. And when I spoke about earlier being a researcher and a clinician working in the sports concussion space, this is the hospital that I collaborate with very, very frequently. So I have my mentor and strongest collaborator based out of Harvard Medical School that operates out of the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Mm-hmm. So the Race for Rehab team is a team that I'm raising funds for. There's probably a link that I can provide for you if you'd like to share it with people.
I have the link. I'll put it in the show notes. So I've got that already. And so this is a date. Will you be able to raise the funds all the way up until the time of the race?
So the deadline is the 22nd of April, and the race is on the 18th. So it's 4 days after the event where we close up the fundraising.
Yeah, so I know this episode will air before that. I know it'll be a couple of weeks from the time we're talking, but I know it'll air before that. So I'll let
people I appreciate the support, and if anybody has an opportunity to make a financial contribution, that's just absolutely fantastic and really appreciate it.
I'll be back to my conversation with Andrew in just a minute. You know, I say this all the time. Your mindset determines your success in running and in life. Your mindset is the story that you tell yourself about yourself. The challenge you face is that the plot and structure of this story that you're telling comes from your unconscious mind, or otherwise known as your subconscious, sometimes is the way it's referred to. If you've ever thought to yourself, you know, I know all the things I need to be doing for success. I need to know all the things I need to be doing to go after that epic life that I want, but I can't seem to find the way to do the things I need to do to get there. There's a word for this. It's called being stuck. If you'd like to get unstuck, I offer a free 25-minute mindset reset phone call with me. I'll help you get a plan to get yourself unstuck, headed for your own epic thing. You can book that call for free at ultramindsetpodcast.run. And desktop, it is in the sidebar. And if you're on your phone, scroll clear to the bottom of all the show notes, and you can find that there, an easy way to schedule. Be glad to help you. Book a call with me to help get you moving towards your epic thing. Now back to my conversation with Andrew. Yeah. And you said you started running around COVID. I mean, really started. It sounded like you started, you know, just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
You were doing it. You said you were doing it before, but you really joined this group a couple of years ago to get serious on your training. So you know, what? I mean, you're fairly kind of new in this or young in this journey. Yeah. What kind of things are you looking forward to?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, I love the trails and I love exploring new trails. Prior to starting with Run Lab 2 years ago, I probably was a park runner. Went out and did the 5K every Saturday morning as fast as I mm-hmm. could, and then when I went out and trained through the week, it would be two or three times a week where I'd just go out and try and run as fast as I can, and try and improve on my previous time. And obviously everybody who's listening to me say this, it's probably a mistake that lots of people make. It's not mm-hmm. an efficient way of training.
And for those of us in the United States, I don't know that I'm not, at least in the area I'm at, parkrun is a term that some may not know. So if I remember it, parkrun is a 5K that's open to like anybody.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll just explain a little bit. So I'm the event director for our local park run, which is a trail run just 10 minutes from my house. And so park run was established initially out of the UK, and it's a 5 kilometer run, as you said, and it's Saturday mornings that they do that, and anybody can do it. All you need to do is just to register, and you bring your barcode along with you, and you do the run, and you get a finish time and a token, and then you get your barcode scanned and it gets put to your profile. So they call it park run, but lots of people walk as well. So it's not necessarily just a run, and they encourage participation rather than racing and trying to get you fastest time necessarily. But there are lots of events around the world. And yes, the US probably don't have as many per capita as many others. But if you jumped on the park run website and had a look at the map, you can see in the UK that when you click on the UK map, there's just dots everywhere because it's just so huge there. And in Australia, it's certainly in our capital cities and even our smaller towns, we have lots and lots. So just in my local area, within a half an hour drive, there's 14. So it's pretty busy and big in some areas and then less so in others.
And I would imagine other areas of the United States, it might be something that, and I'm sure in the Midwest, and you know, United States is big, you know, there's a lot of diversity. Yeah. So it's not something that I'm familiar with. And it could be just, I've not run into anybody. Yeah. The park runs I've heard about have all come from people in Australia I've talked to.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. So I've done four in the States, one in Seattle, which was a beautiful run along the river. I saw trout jumping and a couple of deer, and it was, yeah, just really magnificent. South Boulder, which is probably the greatest altitude I've ever run at, I was pretty gassed. Not used to running that. So that was good fun and really good there. And then I've done one down in Richmond, Virginia, and then also in Boston. So Boston have, well, Boston has one, and then Cambridge, which is in Boston, has another one as well. So there's two there, and there's one also in Vermont. So I hope to get up there to have a look at that one at some point as well.
Well, that's cool. So. But yeah, and so, but park run also, you said you were running as fast as you could. So that's, you know, there's a wide variety. Were there, is there a competition then? A few people who are kind of competing to see who can finish first?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a lot of various things that get put on your profile. So, so you can have the number of times you finish first and there's a number of different badges that you can get. So volunteering to help the, because the park runs run for free, and mm-hmm. you need volunteers to help out. So you get badges for volunteering certain amount of times. But certainly there's in the nation, or in all of the nations, which I think there's about 20 odd nations now that have park run, there's first finisher leaderboard. So we have two female runners or women runners in the Newcastle area where I'm from who are first and third in the overall Australian first finishers list. So they've done over 250 park runs and finished first over 200 times. So, yeah, they do really, really well. And then they have their male equivalent as well. So it doesn't matter if there's five females that finish in the first five positions and then the first male across the line is sixth, they still get that first male finisher position and that will get added.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So there's that. There's also a number of other kind of quirky badges, like, for example, there's a badge called the Stayin' Alive badge, where you need to go to three different park runs starting with B and three different park runs starting with G. So it's the BGs.
That's good. Yeah. I like that.
And then there's a pirates badge as well. So you need to go to seven park runs that start with a C and one park run that starts with an R. So you sail the seven seas and you get the R.
that's creative. Like that.
And then there's a compass badge. So you need to go to a park run that has north, south, east, and west in its title. There's also a Groundhog Day badge where you run the same event. So you might come to the Blue Gum Hills park run, which is the one that I run, and you run 20 minutes flat last Saturday. And then this Saturday you come and you do it again. You run 20 minutes flat at the same park run a week apart.
So okay,
that's the Groundhog Day badge, and there's a bunch of other ones that are pretty cool and nifty as well.
So that's interesting. I will have to look into that and see if one in my area that I just am not aware of.
As soon as we jump off, I'm going to have a look and I'll send it through to you and I'll let you know.
So it is an international organization then.
Yeah. So as I said before, I think there's about 20 nations now. It's largest in the UK. Australia have a lot of events as well. South Africa have quite a few events now. New Zealand have a lot, and the US are growing, so they've got a fair few events. But by comparison to some of the other more established nations, not quite as many. So some of your listeners might not have any that are too local to them, but they might also discover that there's one just around the corner that they never knew
about. Yeah. Oh, they're good. Well, I will try to with this episode. I'll try to also.
You could start one. You could contact Park Run and say, "Hey,
that idea was rolling around in the back of my head." I was like, "Well, but, yeah, there's yeah, we could do that if there's not one here." But I will look up and put a link to Park Run in the show notes for the show. And
yeah, awesome.
So people can. Do that and look it up if because I know that I have listeners that are across the United States. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so that's cool. So that was kind of your introduction to really getting more into it.
Yeah, I think I was playing other sports and I needed to stay fit to be able to execute in those sports as well. But then when it came to more formalized running, and again, park run's not a competitive environment. It's always encouraged for participation. But you do have some fast runners and you do try and keep up with them if you can. So that was good fun. And then, yeah, I guess COVID hit and my mindset changed a little bit in terms of wanting to be better than I was, and knowing that running as fast as I can, as often as I can, was probably not the strategy that was making me any faster or getting me any better. So I went to a more formalized program. So they, because COVID hit, we had lots of restrictions, they changed the format to an online format. So you did your own training on your own while we weren't able to get together. But I had a structure, and having interval training added in there, having strength work added in there, I just noticed that I was not only stripping off some kilos, but also or some pounds, but also getting faster. And yeah, it's been, the consistency is the key with everything, as you know, and just being able to be consistent and to be training smarter, not harder, has been the massive key as well. So it's been great, and had a chance to go in a few events, but also I really enjoy watching other people succeed as well. So just being in this run group and being able to go to events where other people are competing and encouraging them and seeing the joy that they get out of executing on race day is very rewarding for me as well.
Yeah. So did you end up like slowing down? Did you like throw some slow runs in as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Most of my running now is slow runs. So long slow runs. Then you have a couple of interval sessions and a tempo session, and that's about it. So it's pretty close to the 80-20 kind of format that a lot of people talk about and work from.
Yeah, and I've heard that, you know, strategy quite a bit, and and especially among ultra runners. I mean, we tend to look at the distance and not have to. You know, we're looking for that endurance more than the speed is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Time on. So, anything? You know, I know you've got Boston that you're focusing on, but do you have plans for anything beyond that?
Yeah. So. Straight after Boston, a month later, I've got the 100-kilometer UTA that I wasn't able to finish last year that I'm really keen to.
Okay.
And the silver buckle for that is 14 hours. So that will be it'll be interesting to see how I recover after Boston and just whether that's realistic or not for me.
Well, what is the course like? If you have a 48-hour cutoff for 100 kilometers.
Sorry, 14 hours.
14 hours. Oh, okay, I misheard you.
That's, like, that's the silver buckle cutoff.
The silver buckle cutoff. Yeah. Okay.
And the bronze buckle is 20 hours. And I think the overall cutoff might be like 36 potentially ish.
Okay. So still a pretty, that still would indicate a pretty tough course.
Yeah. It's 4,500 meters of elevation and about 5,500 steps up and down. Okay. So staircases that are pretty steep and long. It's a tough one. It's not easy, but I don't know that you could find a 100-kilometer race on the trails that is easy.
Well, each has their own challenges, I know. but oftentimes I kind of look at the cutoff times in the United States, especially if there's less elevation. In fact, we've got some, you know, most of Florida is like flat, like a record player, you know, like an old album. And they struggle to get any kind of elevation at all. It's like going over a bridge, I think, is kind of the most they get. And, but, you know, flat has its own challenges as well.
Absolutely.
But usually the flatter races tend to have a little tighter cutoff times. And
Yeah, it's understandable.
But yeah, there's a race I was looking at the profile, and there's several options. One is 100 miles, and 150 is the most. And the course description was none of it's runnable. It's just all either up or down. And, and so they said you really aren't going to do a whole lot of running. I mean, some of the elite athletes I know can, but. Yeah, it's a pretty rocky, hilly place, and the cutoff was reflective of that difficulty as well.
Sounds brutal.
Yeah.
If you want a mental challenge, go and run in that race.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, and I paced for somebody who was it was called the Outlaw 100.
Yeah.
And it was the race director made it so that it has Leadville is one of the, you know, kind of big races here in the United States.
Yeah.
The race director laid it out so that the elevation, it's not as high in elevation, but the elevation profile is more than Leadville. So,
yeah.
And it's in Oklahoma, which is typically thought of as a flat, flat place to be, but,
amazing.
So, okay. Anything beyond, those two? I mean, you know, looking at what you've got a race that's like a bucket list,
there's nothing that's on my calendar, but there's things that are on my radar.
That's what I was asking. Is like not scheduled, but it was like, oh, someday I would like to go and do that race.
Well, you mentioned Leadville, and that's something that it's probably one of the first races that I ever really looked into and had a look at. So that has some appeal. I also, because I'm very Boston centric, I've spent a lot of time there. I've visited Boston 23 times. I've lived there on fellowships. I wouldn't mind doing the Vermont Miler at some point as well.
Mm-hmm.
I guess anything that comes up, other road marathons are interesting, but I think I'm more probably inclined to go with the trails. So anything that would challenge me that we can't get in Australia. So elevation, or races at elevation, we don't have that many mountains around Australia. We can't really get that high. So anything that challenges you from that perspective, going to the Rockies and, having to go is something that I'd be interested in doing as well.
Yeah. And that's kind of been on my radar too. And I live at a lower elevation and I know going up and trying to run in the mountains is, it has quite a bit of challenge to it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And my only experience is running that 5Ks in South Boulder. And that was tough. So doing an ultra would be
really. Well, I talked to somebody who is lives near me, they went to Colorado Springs, which is about the same elevation as Boulder, to train for I think it was Leadville, then Leadville is at 10,000 feet of elevation instead of 8,000, and that extra 2,000. It just, they were not prepared. And so,
yeah, right. Wow. It's amazing what you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're almost at sea level.
I am, I absolutely am at sea level. And kind of around here on the trails that I typically get on, we're only like 300, 500 meters above sea level. So we can get on the trails and get elevation, but we just can't, we don't have elevation running.
The elevation as far as the as being up high enough to
to
adapt to lower oxygen. Yeah,
so we call them hills and mountains, but we've never been to Europe and North America to see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. If people wanted to reach out to you and find you on social media and follow you, where's the best place to get it?
Yeah, so Instagram is where I'm most active, and that's at the _ultra_mentality. And also my email address, I'm andrew.gardner@newcastle.edu.au if they want to reach out via email.
Okay. And I'll put links, put the links in the show notes as well.
Perfect. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. Really great to chat with you. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. Yes, I say that every week. I do appreciate you being here and taking the time to listen. You can find the show notes for this episode and all the episodes at ultramindsetpodcast.run. Yes, I'm getting used to saying the .run. It is .run, not .com. Sometimes I slip up and still say that, but it's ultramindsetpodcast.run for comments, questions, and stories, as well as the show notes and as the links that, that I talk about here, the Amazon affiliate link, links to the things that I have to offer as a coach and setting goals as a coach and the Crush Your Goals online course. If you did enjoy this episode, want to share it with somebody, think about who might benefit from the things that were discussed here, send them a link. Take just a minute to do that. Remember, an ultramarathon mindset is what you need for success in running and in life. And if you're feeling stuck, you want want to see how Life Coach can help, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule that free 25-minute mindset reset call with me. I'd be glad to help you get unstuck and moving toward your epic thing. Thank you for listening. See you next time.